this episode halts.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 11 of the Beyond Podcast, the podcast that is also questing for the essence of mind and pattern. This is a podcast for anyone who enjoys tautologies and is a fan of this podcast.
Hi, folks. Welcome back. My name is Vadim, and I'll be your host again. Welcome to the podcast that discusses meta concepts. In this episode, I would like to start off with a silly game that kids play and build up to some fascinating meta concepts in mathematics and computer science. This game, often played during road trips and on vacations, is one where players take turns naming larger and larger numbers to see who can name the biggest one.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
No.
Most of these games quickly degenerate when one of the players yells, "Infinity," and the other one replies, "Infinity plus one," and then shouting ensues and escalates until the infinitely patient staff at the Hilbert's hotel where you're staying politely has to inform you that you need to either vacate or move to the next room over because you're disturbing the other guests. But is naming numbers a silly exercise? We sort of take it for granted that once we learn the conventions for naming integers early in our education, we can do it without giving the process too much thought. With great ease, we can listen to somebody say a particular number and then transcribe the number on paper using Arabic numerals, with the most significant digit on the left. With almost the same ease, we can look at a number that is written down and say it out loud. Let me start off by trying to convince you that performing these two tasks, that is, either transcribing a number from a name or saying the name of a number by looking at some digits on a page, is a form of algorithmic computation. And once we start thinking about the deep relationship between naming numbers and algorithms, we can explore how powerful and meta this paradigm can get. I'm going to build a case for how our ability to name numbers evolves with advances in math and computer science. Of course, we're going to be rather general with our definition of what naming means. We will also see that there's a deep relationship between the power of our number naming algorithms and the theoretical machines on which these algorithms are executed, and how that affects the quote-unquote largeness of the numbers that we can name. How does that sound? Good? Good.
And away we go!
So, why is our common everyday practice of verbally communicating numbers like an algorithm? Well, let's take English, for example, but this will work in any language with reasonable support for numerals. If I say something like 8,675,309, and I ask you to write it down, how do you actually go about doing it? What are the mental steps involved? If you can clearly describe this procedure, carried out in your head, then you can write an equivalent computer program to do the same job. It goes something like this. In English, the convention is to communicate a number in blocks that are each some power of 1,000. You can imagine that the number is conveniently written down for us with commas or some other delimiter, separating the thousands from the millions from the billions and so on. We can start with the most significant end of the number. In the previous example, it's in the millions. And we say how many millions there are, then how many thousands, then whatever is left over. Within each power of 1,000 block, we simply have to say a number, or omit a number, between 0 and 999. What is the procedure for that action? Well, here we need to have some kind of lookup table to map values to words. For English, our table needs to have entries for all the decimal digits, 0 through 9. English also has special names for numbers like 11, 12, and so on, all the way up to 19. There are also dedicated names for all the multiples of 10, up to 100. Then we add some rules for composing these. To say the number 85, we have a rule that combines the specific word 80 with whatever word corresponds to what remains, in this case, 5. The same rule would allow us to generate 26 or 42. English also affords us the convenience of building these strictly left to right across the entire algorithm, so 675 in the earlier example. Now, in some languages, you might have an inversion, like German's "42", which is rendered as a compound word, literally meaning 2 and 40.
The answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything is 42.
And English can also have some playful variations, like the character Bilbo celebrating his 111st birthday in The Lord of the Rings. But we can ignore these for our basic algorithm.
I don't know half of you half as well as I should like, and I like less than half of you half as well as you deserve.
Other languages may have their own idiosyncrasies for naming numbers. For example, in French, they don't say 85, they say 4 times 25, and I think that's beautiful. We could certainly express these language-specific variations in our algorithm. And in English, if we simply have a way of naming numbers between 0 and 999, and then have the additional table that names all the powers of 1,000 up to some useful limit, then we have the full algorithm for how to say a number out loud, or conversely, how to interpret a number that is being named verbally. So if you heard me say 8,675,309, you would just write the digits 8675309 left to right, and that would exactly correspond to what I said. By the way, did I say 09 for the 09 at the end? Must be another playful variation.
Damn you, Tommy Two-Tone!
So here's a question. If we built our mental algorithm, or its computer equivalent, to support numbers all the way up to 999 million, how much work would it be to add support for billions? Well, in US English, a billion is 1,000 million. So does that mean that our expanded computer program requires 1,000 times more rules as compared to our first implementation? Actually, we only need to add a single new rule to our program, the word for billion, and nothing else. The rest of our mental code works exactly as before, and if we want to expand to trillions, that's just one more word or one more rule. In the parlance of complexity analysis, which is a topic in computer science that is concerned with how the difficulty of problems affects a computer's ability to solve them, we would say that our program size grows as a logarithm in the size of the numeric value that we wish to express. And more precisely, it grows as the logarithm base 1,000. So going from a million to a billion is just a step of 1 power of 1,000, so just one extra small piece of code to add. And to go from a million to a quadrillion, that's only 3 new rules, just 3 extra words for billion, trillion, and quadrillion. These 3 words give us the literal power to express a billion times more different numbers as compared to the program that only went up to millions. Now, this might seem rather mundane, but I think it's a testament to how gracefully and compactly our language has evolved to express numerals. One can imagine all sorts of hypothetical, awkward schemes that would make it almost impractical to reason or communicate about large numbers. Instead, we have collectively invented a mechanism where adding a single new word gives you 1,000 times the expressive power. And yes, in everyday communications, we may rarely name numerals beyond, let's say, a billion or a trillion, but we've come up with names for much larger numbers. Do you, for some reason, need to express 10 to the power of 57? Well, why not say octodecillion? If you have ever played the paperclip simulator game, you may be very familiar with this nomenclature, because you see, in the world of the paperclip simulator, these numbers start to matter a whole lot to the fate of the universe and all the nice matter that's floating around in it.
Tens of billions of years in the far future.
If you haven't played that game, go try it now. I will wait. Did you try it? Good. By the way, when I just described an octodecillion as 10 to the power 57, that was a bit of a cheat, wasn't it? Up to this point, our discussion of number naming conventions was confined to a very specific type of number naming, which required an explicit word for each power of 1,000. And the number writing system that goes along with this convention would require more and more digits on the page as the number gets larger and larger. Every power of 10 requires an extra digit. Numbers 1 through 9 can be written with a single character. Numbers 10 through 99 require 2 characters. In general, given our base 10 number writing system, the number of characters to express an integer grows as log base 10 in the size of the number. But when we said 10 to the power of such and such, we introduced a whole new paradigm. Once we agree upon this convention for writing numbers, what happens? The number we call a million can be named as 10 to the 6. You can imagine writing down the digits 1 and 0, then some kind of character that represents the power operation, then the digit 6. So 4 characters on the page give us a million. And if we want to talk about a billion, that's just 1, 0, the power symbol, and then the number 9. Still just the 4 characters. When will we need another character? Well, by the time we journey from a billion to a trillion, we will need to be able to write down 1, 0, the power symbol, and then a 1 and a 2 to express 10 to the 12th. Now we're at 5 symbols. This shift into using the power or exponent operator to express numbers is indeed a paradigm shift. Now, our representation grows as double log base 10 in the size of a number. That is exponentially slower growth than our digit base scheme. Think about this. We can go from 1 to 10 billion in just a single step. We start with just the 4 characters expressing 10 to the 0th power, which is just 1, to 5 characters expressing 10 to the 10th, which is 10 billion.
We hold the world ransom for 100 billion dollars.
It is so easy for us modern humans to take this for granted. Sometime in primary school, we learn how exponents work, starting with something being squared, cubed, then generalizing to any power. But historically, well, Archimedes, who lived in the 3rd century before the Common Era, wrote about the powers of 10 and the properties of exponents. But it wasn't until something like the 17th century when mathematicians had started to formalize this notation using conventions like a superscript to express exponentiation. So now we have 2 related but different algorithms for writing and naming numbers. By now, I have hopefully convinced you that these are indeed algorithms, although in everyday use we just think of them as conventions.
The code is more what you'd call guidelines than actual rules.
Now let's come back to our game of kids trying to outdo each other with number naming. If, let's say, your younger kid yells out 999999 and so on, and keeps saying nines until they run out of lung capacity, we can see how the older kid can effortlessly beat them by just saying 10 to the power of 1000 without even having to take a deep breath first. Double log 10 growth is quite amazing. Now let's take a step back and look at the inspirations behind this discussion topic. In 1999, the computer scientist Scott Aronson published an essay titled "Who Can Name the Bigger Number?" In this essay, he starts off by presenting a more formal version of his biggest number naming game. Allow me to read to you Aronson's rules. By the way, we mentioned Scott Aronson in the previous episode of the podcast, citing his commentary on a meta problem in quantum mechanics stemming from observing observers. Go and listen to that episode if you haven't already. But meanwhile, here are the rules of the game. You have 15 seconds. Using standard math notation, English words, or both, name a single whole number, not an infinity, on a blank index card. Be precise enough for any reasonable modern mathematician to determine exactly what number you have named by consulting only your card and, if necessary, the published literature. Now you can imagine our hypothetical younger kid grabbing the index card and writing a bunch of nines or 1 followed by as many zeros as they can muster in 15 seconds. The older kid can take the same approach but start with 10, the exponent symbol, and then, just like their younger siblings, start writing as large of an exponent as they can to emit onto the index card before the time runs out. We already know that the older sibling is using a much faster paradigm for expressing large numbers. But what if there's an even older, wiser, more learned sibling on the road trip with us who knows even more powerful paradigms for specifying numbers? We'll learn these tricks shortly. The gist of Aronson's essay is that our collective ability to express and reason about increasingly large numbers moves forward every time a new paradigm is discovered in mathematics. He says, "Such paradigms are historical rarities, but when a new way to express big numbers concisely does emerge, it is often a byproduct of a major scientific revolution, systemized mathematics, formal logic, computer science. Thus, is the story of big numbers a story of human progress?" Of course, there's a link to this essay in the transcript of this episode, which is available at thebeyondpod.com. I highly recommend reading Who Can Name the Bigger Number. Aronson is a great communicator of math and science. He is now, and he was already great at it when he was 18 years old when he published this essay. So now that I have shared one of the inspirations for this episode, I want to explore 2 aspects of number naming. One is, well, what are these paradigms that are even more powerful than exponents? How do you win the 15-second number naming game, or at least place near the top? Secondly, I want to look at algorithms implicit in these paradigms. What does the power of each successive paradigm mean for the type of algorithm that would implement it? What kind of programming languages and what kind of theoretical or physical machines, such as digital computers, would be required to actually run such an algorithm? And finally, are there number naming paradigms that are beyond our ability to compute? What does it even mean to have a number naming scheme that is beyond the powers of computation?
It could take an hour, or it could take 100 million years.
At this point, we need to bring in our friend Douglas Hofstadter and his programming languages called Bloop, Floop, and Gloop. Yes, that guy again. In Good O Escherbach, Hofstadter has a chapter where he proposes these three toy computer languages. Now, in my notes, the word toy is in quotes because Bloop and Floop are actually perfectly reasonable languages for which one could build a compiler or an interpreter. Gloop is another story. So let's start with Bloop. Don't worry if you're not familiar with computer programming. We will distill the essential details of these toy languages and the power they give us. Hofstadter proposes a reasonable starter language, complete with a grammar and semantics. The language is designed to manipulate natural numbers. Out of the box, it offers us ways to group code into blocks and group blocks into named subroutines. These subroutines take as input one or more numbers, or booleans, and return a single result value, which can be a natural number or a boolean, so either true or false.
That equals true.
The language is carefully designed to restrict the types of loops that can be built. Specifically, the number of times you run through a loop must be fixed before the loop begins. For example, we're allowed to say that some computational steps must be performed exactly 3 times, or that a loop can run for no more than n times, where n is some value computed earlier in the program. This is fine. However, we cannot have a loop without a bound, or a loop where the bound changes as the loop executes.
Then shalt thou count to 3. No more, no less.
Nor are we equipped with statements such as the goto that would allow us to effectively construct arbitrary repetitions. We also cannot call a subroutine from within itself, nor are we allowed to call a subroutine before it is defined in the text of our code. This prevents the type of looping you can get where A calls A recursively, or A calls B and then B calls A, and so on.
5 is right out.
It is this feature of bounded loops that gives the language its name, Bloop. You might wonder how this language is different from practical everyday computer languages. Let's say we extended this language in various ergonomic ways to make it more palatable to a modern software developer. We could add support for richer types, beyond natural numbers, and true and false. We could add more operators so that operations like multiplication and division could be expressed more naturally, and so on. We could also think about adding better support for data structures. But let's say that no matter what, we are forced to retain these properties of loops being bounded. What sort of limitations does this place on the expressiveness of our language? This consideration brings us back to the biggest number game, because as we hinted earlier, there is a deep connection between the expressiveness of programming languages and the ability to name a number. Let's work our way up to this by going back to basics. I suppose we need to start back at kindergarten, or even pre-kindergarten level, where we first learned to count. At that age, teachers don't usually tell us about the successor function. In fact, it's probably fair to assume that most folks will never have to think about counting in terms of this thing called the successor function. But this function, which we also mentioned back in episode 1 and episode 8, is a fundamental building block of mathematics. In the axioms of piano arithmetic, we established that the successor of a natural number is also a natural number, and there is no natural number whose successor is 0. Again, see episode 8. Repeated applications of the successor function are analogous to what we intuitively think of as counting. We can say that the successor of 0 is 1, and the successor of 0 is 2. But the labels 1 and 2 are just conveniences. It is perfectly reasonable to write down S of 0 to mean 2, or perhaps some larger number of applications of S to represent larger numbers. It's just not very practical.
Oh, does that confuse you?
But imagine that you were at that hypothetical critical stage in your math development where you didn't yet know how to write down numbers in any conventional way. Let's pretend all you knew is how to write down vertical sticks. So one stick is one, two sticks is two, and so on. Then the best you can do during Scott Aronson's 15-second challenge is to jot down as many sticks on the index card as you can. This seems like an unsophisticated approach, although if instead you wrote down many letters S for successor, with balanced nested parentheses to represent repeated applications of the successor function, we might think that you know a bit more about mathematics than you're letting on. And yet, the number of S's on the page would give us the same value as the equivalent number of vertical sticks. Let's kick it up a notch. Let's say your math education has progressed as far as addition. Addition gives us a sort of a life hack. We can seamlessly perform many counting steps in one operation. We can say that adding the number B to the number A is the same as applying the successor function to the number A, B times. So A plus 2 is the same as S of S of A. Our teachers might have told us that addition is like repeated counting. In fact, kids often use that equivalence by counting on their fingers as a way of getting the result of an addition problem. And then when we learn about multiplication, do the teachers actually tell us it's just repeated addition? I think it sort of depends on where you learn math. In some places, one learns multiplication through rote memorization of multiplication tables. You are then taught a general algorithm for multiplying multi-digit numbers using a pen and paper. In some curricula, this is also supplemented by an appeal to geometry or visual intuition, perhaps by connecting multiplication of two integers to a way of computing the area of a rectangle.
Eureka!
But purely algorithmically, A times B is the same as A written out B times with pluses between the A's. Later in school, we learn about exponents. Hopefully, the teachers explain this in terms of repeated multiplication. Just like in the previous examples, A to the power of B is just A written out B times with multiplication symbols between the A's. As an aside, I find it a curious thing about human brain development that these three concepts are presented to us years apart in our education. Kids start counting as early as 2 or 4 years of age before they enter kindergarten. We learn about addition in kindergarten or maybe in first grade. We learn and refine multiplication skills in second through fourth grades. Exponents introduced in fifth grade or beyond. And of course, it has to be that way in order for us to internalize and build intuition about these concepts. These things just take time. But most people will never go on to learn about operations beyond exponents. What are these operations? Well, let's extend our intuition forward. If exponentiation is just repeated multiplication, what if we wanted to do repeated exponentiation? Let's call this operation tetration. This term was coined by the mathematician Reuben Goodstein. The idea behind this terminology is that we can think of the successor function, addition, multiplication, and so on, not as distinct and special concepts, but rather a family of functions that we can refer to by their index. Each function, as we saw earlier, is a loop around the previous function in the sequence. The successor function is at index 0, addition is at index 1, multiplication is 2, and exponentiation is 3. The next function, which should represent repeated exponentiation, is at index 4. Goodstein called it tetration, using the Greek prefix tetra for the number 4. We could go further, of course. Pentation, from the Greek prefix for 5, is just repeated tetration, and so on. Just to give you some intuition for what tetration looks like in practice, let's take the more familiar exponentiation function and write down 2 to the power of 3. We know that this is just repeated multiplication, so we can rewrite this as 2 times 2 times 2, which is just 8. Again, visualize this as the first number A written out B times with the operands in between. So now let's tetrate 2 by 3. I know this terminology sounds rather weird. It's just not in the realm of our daily lives. So again, we write down the number 2 3 times. Except this time we write down the exponent symbol in between, so 2 to the power of 2 to the power of 2. Here we need to stipulate the order of operations by treating the exponent operator as right associative. That means we have to work our way from right to left by first raising 2 to the power of 2 and getting 4, and then raising 2 to the fourth power to get 16. You can see that tetration quickly gives us very large numbers. For example, 2 to the power of 4 is merely 16, but 2 tetrated by 4 is 2 to the power of 2 to the power of 2 to the power of 2, which is a whopping 65,536. Are we feeling brave enough to try pentation? Oh boy. Let's try pentating 2 by 4. I should note that while the spell checker in my word processor gave me a pass on tetration, it angrily underlined the words pentation and pentating in the previous sentence. So again, we write down the number 2 4 times, and in between the 2s we will write down the symbol for tetration. Except, what is the symbol? It's certainly not something that we learned in school. For reasons I will explain shortly, let us use 2 arrows pointing up as this new operator. So we will write 2, 2 up arrows, 2, 2 up arrows, 2, 2 up arrows, 2. Again, we will work our way right to left. 2 tetrated by 2 is just 4, so no biggie. We can now rewrite our sequence as 2, up arrow, up arrow, 2, up arrow, 4. Again, working from the right, we consider 2, up arrow, 4, which we know from our previous example as being equal to 65,536. Now we're left with 2, up arrow, 65,536. Now just try to visualize a stack of exponents where it's 2 to the 2 to the 2 and so on, and the height of this stack is 65,536 minus 1. This is a truly enormous number, far beyond the naming power of even those fancy numerals referenced in the paperclip simulator game. At this point, our results grow to dizzying heights faster than anything we've seen before.
Big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is.
But keep in mind that once we've abstracted away from specific familiar named operations like addition, multiplication, and so on, we are now free to stack these operations further and further. We can call repeated pentation hexation if we stick with the Greek prefixes, or we can abandon trying to give everything a catchy name that confuses our spell checkers and just think about the index n of every successive operation and how we can express it in terms of a repeated application of the operation at index n minus 1. By the way, the double up arrow notation that we used earlier, this comes from the computer scientist Donald Knuth and is known as, drumroll, Knuth's up arrow notation. By convention, a single up arrow is equivalent to the exponent operator, but 2 arrows represent tetration, 3 arrows represent pentation, and so on. This is a bit confusing, but basically take the Greek prefix, subtract 2, and you get the right number of Knuth up arrows for the operation that you want to express. Using more and more arrows saves us from having to come up with clever new Greek names or developing distinct symbols for the infinite number of these hyper-operations that are now accessible to us, now that we've gone beyond the familiar. By the way, I think that hyper-operation is an amazing term. Okay, now let's connect this all back to Bloop. If you recall, the Bloop language gave us the means to write computer programs with strictly bounded loops. Even with this restriction, the language is actually quite powerful. We could build programs in Bloop to do all sorts of useful calculations. However, there's a catch. We are limited to a class of computable functions called primitive recursive. Primitive recursive functions are made up of specific mathematical building blocks, which correspond nicely and by design to the building blocks of the Bloop language. For example, a primitive recursive function can just be a constant value regardless of the input. Our friend the successor function is also primitive recursive. There are ways we're allowed to compose these functions together, with the composition also being a function of the same class. Finally, there is something called the primitive recursion operator, which allows us, in effect, to define functions that loop over other functions. There is a direct translation between the mathematical notation used in this branch of mathematics and computer programming languages that have our familiar building elements such as subroutines, blocks, loops, basic data types, and conditionals. Hofstadter quite deliberately designed the Bloop language to be exactly as expressive as primitive recursion, but no stronger than that. As a result, any primitive recursive mathematical function can be expressed in Bloop, and conversely, the language cannot to represent anything requiring more power than primitive recursion. So what does this mean for the fancy types of hyperoperations that we've discussed so far? Sure, Bloop can do addition and multiplication. Can it do exponentiation? Absolutely. We can just express that as a loop over multiplication, which is itself a loop over addition. If Bloop had not featured addition as a basic building block, but only provided a successor function, that would just be one more loop for us. And titration? Sure, we can implement exponentiation and then write a new routine that loops as it calls the exponent subroutine. In fact, for any specific value of n, where n represents the number of up arrows in the Knuth up arrow notation we introduced earlier, we can write a Bloop program that computes that particular function. Recall that for titration, n equals 2, and so on. Okay, so far so good. But what if we're not sure ahead of time what n is? Let's say we wanted to build a general purpose routine that could take integers a and b and another parameter n and compute the value of a followed by n up arrows B. This is where it starts to get tricky. To throw in some more terminology your way, this new function we're interested in, where the hyperoperation index is itself a parameter, this is known as the Ackermann function, discovered by the mathematician Wilhelm Ackermann. On one hand, it might seem like a trivial requirement. After all, n is just another parameter to our program. However, here we're using n in a rather novel way. It is an index into a catalog of other functions. The way the recursive step in the Ackermann function is defined requires a more powerful form of recursion than primitive recursion. And that also means that Bloop cannot express a program that computes hyperoperations for an arbitrary value of n. So we need a programming language more powerful than Bloop. This is where Floop enters the room. While Bloop required bounded loops, Floop allows free loops, where the program can loop without an explicit upper bound. We normally take this sort of thing for granted in our everyday programming languages, where starting a loop with while true is a perfectly reasonable thing to do.
Oh dear! She's stuck in an infinite loop, and he's an idiot.
And while Bloop was by design not Turing complete and could only compute primitive recursive functions, Floop and equivalent Turing complete languages can solve a more general class of total computable functions that are not just primitive recursive. So now that we're armed with our knowledge of hyperoperators, can we beat our classmates and friends at the number naming game? If you, and only you, are familiar with the up arrow notation, you can easily jot down a representation of a number that is so huge that nobody else in the group should even bother. Just take the number 2, followed by some number of up arrows, and it won't take many, and then another number like 5. And if you're armed with the knowledge of the Ackermann function or one of its flavors, just write down an invocation of that function over some inputs. Recall that the parameters to this function don't need to be large. They will still produce outputs that dwarf anything that you can try to express with a less powerful paradigm. In fact, this is the approach that Aronson suggests in his essay. The beautiful thing here is that this fundamental and historically recent insight in mathematics about the different levels of recursion gave us a new paradigm for expressing even larger numbers than we could have ever before. Finally, we should also mention Gloop or Gloop, the ultimate programming language introduced in the same chapter of Gödel, Escher, Bach. Gloop is even more powerful than Floop. Why, it can even decide if a given Floop program will terminate or run forever by just solving the halting problem.
Two dings means it's done. But not like that. Slightly more rapid.
Do you remember the halting problem for our discussions in episode 8? Go and listen to that episode. I will wait. Did you listen to it? Good. A paradigm like Gloop, which is even more powerful than Turing machines, would allow us to somehow handle functions that grow faster than any computable function. For example, we could compute Kolmogorov complexity, discussed in episode 9, or the Chaitin constant, as well as the Busy Beaver function. The Busy Beaver function tells us the maximum number of steps that a computer program of size n could run for and halt. For a given size of program, we could run the program, and if it does not stop in Busy Beaver of n steps, we could immediately conclude that the program will run forever without halting. The ability to compute this bound, the Busy Beaver of n, for an arbitrary n, would be equivalent to solving the halting problem. Of course, Gloop isn't a real language, and we have no way of constructing such a language, i.e. something more powerful than all the Turing languages, such as Floop. There are, of course, theoretical constructs in computer science that posit the existence of computing machines that go beyond Turing machines. And then, of course, you can start asking questions about the limitations of these machines, and then think about even more powerful machines and so on and so on. It's turtles all the way up. But I don't think it would be cheating if we used our knowledge of concepts like the busy beaver function to try and get an edge in the number naming game. Even though it is not computable, the busy beaver function is well defined. So we could get clever and write down something like busy beaver of n, where n is some number that itself need not be very large. If our peers in the game are limited to only computable functions, and even if they know about the amazing power of the Ackermann function, we could still easily dominate the game by bringing in the machinery of the busy beaver. I want to end this episode by sharing the ideas from some number naming enthusiasts in my own life. I presented Scott Aronson's challenge to some kids ages 9 to 12, and here were some ideas they brainstormed. But keep in mind that kids these days have access to a lot of online content, and there's plenty of material out there that covers math and science in an entertaining and appealing way. So here are their suggestions for what to write down on the index card. Graham's number, tree 3, tree of Graham's number, tree of Graham's number, drumroll, factorial, and so on. I included a YouTube link in the transcript to a video explaining what the heck tree 3 is. You can also look up Graham's number if you're interested. Although discussing these concepts is very much in line with the theme of this episode, my energy is finite, as I am sure is your patience. As for my own entry in the 15-second number naming game, I decided to be sneaky, so I would write down something like the maximum of all the other responses plus 1. I'm guaranteed to win as long as no one else in the room is as sneaky as I am. Otherwise, we'll be stuck in there forever.
Pretty sneaky, sis.
Well, I guess that just about wraps it up. Thank you, as always, for listening. The transcript of this podcast is available at thebeyondpod.com. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the discussion topics, you can email me at thebeyondpod@gmail.com. Tell me about your favorite number naming paradigm. But for now, thanks again, and goodbye.